We couldn't do this podcast without the support of the team at Topic, so we want to give them a little love back. First off, if you haven't already, you should absolutely go check out Topic.com. Topic.com is a new destination for visual storytelling, original series, short films, photo essays, and illustration, focusing on a unique theme each month. August's theme is female trouble. The issue features a variety of comedic and dramatic narratives examining the struggles women confront and the ones they embrace and initiate. As you know from this podcast, these days crazy headlines and split-second responses are everywhere. Topic wants to offer an alternative to that, a deliberate point of view, one that is more curious, ambitious, thought-provoking, and open-minded. They're devoted to independent creators with a strong point of view about the issues of our times. They want to create stories that provoke, delight, and intrigue audiences. So show this site some love. Go to Topic.com or find them on social at Topic Stories and subscribe to their newsletter for updates and new releases.
Hey, most people hate Nazis, right? This should not be a hard sell, right? This should be a real easy sell to most people.
From Topic and Earwolf, this is Politically Reactive. I'm W. Kamau Bell.
And I'm the most recent reincarnation of Lord Vishnu, Hari Kundabolu.
A show where two comedians try to make sense of politics in America. Good point. On today's show, we take a deep dive into free speech. Since I'm the ACLU's celebrity ambassador for racial justice, I decided to call them up and ask them about their decision to help the Unite the Right rally keep their protest permit in Charlottesville. On today's show, we have the ACLU's senior staff attorney, Lee Rowland.
Can I swear on the show?
You can swear, yes.
Oh my God.
We also talked to Antifa expert Mark Bray about the origins of the movement in the U.S. and how it is trying to end fascism.
Also joining us today, because you can never have too much show, is one of my favorite follows on Twitter, April Rain. She created the famous hashtag OscarSoWhite a few years back, and she's recently helped create a new hashtag, NoConfederate. This hashtag was created in the wake of HBO announcing that the producers of Game of Thrones were going to make a new show about what if the South had won the Civil War and slavery was still legal. Tuning in, Hari?
No.
It's all coming up on Politically Reactive. Hey, Hari.
Hey, Kamau.
How's it going, sir?
Good, man. I was in San Diego over the weekend. A lot of people love our podcast. People were really touched by the podcast, especially the Charlottesville episode that we had done that week.
Yeah, and if people didn't realize, we did release a bonus episode, so it might have snuck into your podcast feed without you realizing, because we asked you guys to call us and give us your thoughts about Charlottesville. And so the producers worked through the weekend, which they didn't have to do, to create this bonus episode. So yeah, check it out. It's in your podcast feed. It's basically just recorded messages from you guys calling us. So thanks for doing that, and we'll probably do it again because it was really powerful. So before we get to today's show, you know, there's a lot going on in the news, but this is something that touches both of us in a more personal way. Saturday, August 19th, Dick Gregory passed away. You know, I had my, you know, it's that thing where your phone goes bloop and your news alert comes up and it was said Dick Gregory. And I was just like, oh, no, I immediately knew, you know, he was 84 years old, lived a lot of life in 84 years.
For those of you who don't know who Dick Gregory is, really a pioneering stand-up comic, was the first black comedian to perform stand-up comedy in white nightclubs. A lot of people would say that he performed flat-footed, meaning that like so many of the comics or the black performers of the era had to dance, had to do multiple things. And Dick Gregory, no, he stood on stage,
yep,
and he told jokes and he shared his truth with a range of people, including white people, and he was not afraid.
I just moved into an all-white neighborhood not too long ago in Chicago, and I didn't have no problems when I moved in because the neighbors that lived on each side of me, they were like out of the country. They were over in London on vacation having a ball. Just singing, America the Beautiful, going home, going. If they only knew what they was coming home to.
As we talk about activism in the arts right now, there's a lot of talk about the NFL and, you know, Colin Kaepernick. And, you know, what responsibility do entertainers have? Dick Gregory, at the height of his career. You know, and we, you know, stepped away to pursue activism, to be more, so he could actually do more work on the ground. So he knew he couldn't do both at the same time. And also, as you were saying, he understood that, like, being on stage is not actually the work.
No.
He's a powerful presence. The great thing about Dick Gregory is that he kept he kept speaking throughout his entire life.
Things got a little strange at the end.
If you go to down a deep Dick Gregory hole on YouTube,
yeah.
I feel like he's an 84-year-old black man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He was just like, who, you know, in his lifetime, you know, he saw, you know, Martin Luther King, I Have a Dream, March with King.
Yeah.
And he saw Trump as president, and he was also on J. Edgar Hoover's enemies list.
Right.
So it's like,
at that point, anything is possible.
Yeah.
So.
Where's the line between conspiracy and coordinated action? So just to let you know how funny it was, this is a clip. This is my favorite clip of Dick Gregory. It's from 2008. It's from the State of the Black Union, where you have to picture a dais on stage with all of the biggest and sort of most influential black leaders, some politicians, some activists. Cornel West is there. Donna Brazile is there. Like all these people. And everybody gets a few minutes to sort of talk about what they think is important. And then it was Dick Gregory's turn, and it turned into a nightclub.
I wish Bill Clinton was here so I would apologize to him for you black folks. See, you black folks tricked him. You went in that big old black pot and said, here, white boy, you black. Huh? And then you went back in that black pot and said, here, Obama, you ain't black enough. What kind of fool is you? Huh? What kind of fool is you? So I tell Bill Clinton, ain't nothing wrong with being black as long as you're playing. But when you try to use it as your address, Mr. President, do you know what it feels like to be a black person, to be a Congress lady, to be a lieutenant governor, with 12 doctor's degree and driving down the street and hear the police siren and you start squeezing that steering wheel tight and they pass by you and you thank God, damn thanking God, you didn't do nothing in the first place.
So one thing we should mention is that in this episode, I handle a couple of the interviews solo because Hari doesn't like to work as hard as I do.
I was asked if I wanted to work as hard, and I said no.
Yeah, so he's not trying to win. And so...
I was on tour.
Yeah, yeah.
I've been on tour.
Me too. And one of them, I think it makes sense. It's with the ACLU, and I really felt like, as the person who's the ACLU's ambassador for racial justice, that I felt like I should probably handle that because it would be weird to have somebody there who's not an ambassador for anything.
This interview was recorded on August 21st, 2017. On this day in 2000, Tiger Woods won the 82nd PGA Championship, becoming the first golfer since Ben Hogan in 1953 to win three majors in a calendar year. Several years later, Tiger Woods would get his fuck on, ending his career.
So last week's show, we focused entirely on what went down in Charlottesville. And, of course, the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, was the topic of that discussion. If you recall, Rosa Clemente, who formerly had worked with the ACLU, had thoughts about why she wouldn't work with them again.
We need to be very critical at this moment right now around the American Civil Liberties Union, because I hold them partly responsible for that. They went to court to protect these white supremacists who were not saying, we're going to have a rally and expose or excuse our hate speech, that we're also ready to fight and violently espouse that speech.
The ACLU represented Jason Kessler, the organizer of the Unite the Right rally, as he fought to keep the group's permit to protest the removal of Confederate statue Robert E. Lee. The city of Charlottesville attempted to revoke the group's permit because of safety concerns. Many, including Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe, blamed the ACLU for the violence that followed, resulting in the death of racial justice activist Heather Heyer. And even though the ACLU has changed their policy and will no longer defend hate groups that carry firearms while protesting, I found it necessary to speak with someone there to get some clear answers. Joining me now is Lee Rowland. She is a senior staff attorney with the ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
So I'll just talk about it from my perspective for a little bit. Like, because it's somebody who is affiliated with the ACLU through being the I have a hard time saying it because it always makes me feel like I'm giving myself credit for something I don't deserve. Celebrity ambassador for racial justice. So people see me as that. I talk about that. It's in my bio. You know, I'm proud of that. So that means that, like, when the ACLU was at the airports during the first wave of the Muslim ban, and there's all these sort of tweets that go out of pictures of lawyers who've been brought there by the ACLU to, like, sort of help get people into the country who should have been in the country, that I sort of felt like, yeah, that's me.
Yeah, you know, I like these people.
Yeah, yeah. And also, no, that's actually, no, you see, I'm a bigger egomaniac than that. That's me.
That's you. Actually, literally
that's
you.
That's part of the work I do.
Gotcha.
You know, I'm a comedian, so it's I'm also an only child, so it's all about me.
I'm with you on that. I mean, I'm an only child.
Yeah, so you understand. So then that means that when this thing that happens with Charlottesville and the ACLU of Virginia helps Unite the Right get that permit for the rally, that and then I hear friends of mine and activists who are upset at the ACLU of Virginia for doing that, that also becomes me.
Yeah.
And then I suddenly realize, oh, I don't actually know what to say about this. I'm not in the hallways of this place to be able to say this is what the decision was. And so my first question is, what is it like in the hallways of the ACLU right now?
Well, I think it's raw. I mean, I'm a white lady and I've done First Amendment work my entire career as a lawyer, and I'm struggling, right? I mean, I can't even begin to compare it with you putting yourself out there as a racial justice ambassador. But it's a weird moment because as a lawyer, you know, there's something fundamentally regressive about the law, right? And in fact, I would even argue that the entire practice of law is done through a white lens in the sense that your job is to advocate.
Wait a minute, that was question six. What? How'd you get there already?
Oh, wait, really? Amazing. Well, I mean, it's important to acknowledge I went to law school with a pretty complex set of emotions about it. I was mm-hmm. first person in my family to go to college, let alone kind of professional school. And I knew I was getting into a world that is fundamentally conservative. Indeed, I would argue fundamentally regressive in the mm-hmm. sense that how the law works is you look at, has this been protected before?
Yeah.
And then you say, oh, if we did, then we're going to do it again, right? The past is normative in the law as a formal matter. That's how the analysis works. And so I don't think anybody can get into the law or shouldn't deluding themselves with the heart-soaring idea that you're going to be at the front of a real resistance in a way that's separated from the structural race and gender issues that have pervaded our judiciary, mm-hmm. right? These are the cream of the cream of the crop, which means they are the essence of privilege. Judges. I'm talking about judges.
Yeah.
And so I think one thing that is just important.
And by cream of the crop, you mean mostly white.
White, right. Cream. Thank you for taking
no
my
problem,
double
no
entendre,
problem.
Which may or may not have been a progress.
I did that myself.
So I think, you know, one thing that I hope everybody can believe, and I, you know, you can only take my word for it, is nobody who works at the ACLU gets up in the morning to represent a Nazi. There is not one person, right, who sleeps well at night when that happens. I've done this work my whole career. I never sleep well when I represent someone who is hateful or who really gives me pause about the world they want to see, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Instead, we've bought into this idea, and I think it can be fairly criticized, and I can certainly take it if you mm-hmm. want to criticize it, is that there is a value in having at least one group that is viewed as widely left of center. And mm-hmm. I think we fairly are, right, mm-hmm. in terms of the fact that we do fight for racial justice and transgender justice and, you know, gender equality every single day. But we've bought into the idea that along with that, that we maintain some of these principles, particularly in the First Amendment arena, but that's not the only place, like due process, right? Mm-hmm. We fight against the death penalty no matter how hateful that person is who's been sentenced to death, that if we maintain neutrality and fight for some of these principles at a core level, that's where our power lies, right? Mm-hmm. Our power doesn't lie on the First Amendment or the Fourth Amendment or on death penalty because we're a progressive resistance organization. Our power lies there because we're we peep players in the judiciary, and we go in there no matter whether you're pro-choice or anti-choice, no matter whether you're right or left, no matter whether you're a Nazi or not, right? Because the ACLU actually has a long history of representing hateful people, including literal Nazis, right? That the idea is if we keep doing this, that what we'll do is we'll rise the tide in a fairly white judiciary, right? For people like, and this is historically true, not just a random example, a KKK leader named Charles Brandenburg. He's something called the incitement test, is also known as the Brandenburg test, when you hear people kind of offhandedly say you can't shout fire in a crowded theater. But the idea is that that's where our power lies, is in being principled, in doing it despite who the speaker is, despite how hateful their voices are, despite that Charles Brandenburg is a KKK leader, because then we go to court 10 years later and we protect those same words coming out of the mouth of Charles Evers, who's a NAACP leader who's organizing a boycott. And he says some, you know, he gets carried away, says some high rhetoric. And that language he says, you know, is protected by the Supreme Court begrudgingly, because they look back and they say, oh, well, we protected this white guy who we can probably envision having a cocktail with at some point, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe we can't empathize with Charles Evers, but we're constrained because we just hit this high watermark and now we got to hold it. And so that's been the analysis for the last 100 years of the ACLU's First Amendment work. Yeah. And I think it's valid and I'll defend it. What I think is also really valid is to point out that as a factual matter, we're at a moment in time where that good for the goose, good for the gander rings a little hollow when the power of organized white supremacy is ascendant and is echoing through the halls of the White House, right?
Yeah.
How do we incorporate that into our advocacy? And although I'm totally open to criticism and discussing it, I'm just going to be honest that I don't see us getting to a place where the ACLU has a rule that we don't defend people who are hateful. I think that's unlikely. I think it's unlikely that we're going to say we don't defend people who believe in a white supremacist ideology. Although, again, I think that's a fair conversation to have. What I do think we should do, and I think what we've always done, but maybe we were a little naive about this current moment, and that is eminently criticizable, is that as a factual matter, defending Nazis in Skokie, which is a historical moment that a lot of people know about for the ACLU. And it's so bizarre that I'm now in a week where I'm starting a sentence this way. Forgive me, world. But say what you will about the Nazis in Skokie. That was on the record. You know, the fact show, that was a peaceful march. Indeed, it was planned as a silent march. It never happened, of course. They effectuated the principle and then kind of pathetically dispersed. They didn't have enough power.
Hold up. Wait a minute.
For those of you who don't know, the ACLU has defended Nazis and other groups you might not like for quite some time now. In 1978, they defended a neo-Nazi group who wanted to march through Skokie, a Chicago suburb that was the home to many Holocaust survivors. The Illinois Supreme Court prohibited the National Socialist or Nazi Party of America from marching in uniform, displaying swastikas, or distributing any materials which incite or promote hatred against persons of Jewish faith or ancestry, or hatred against persons of any faith or ancestry, race, or religion. This case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court found that Illinois had to let the Nazis march unless their march can be proven to incite violence and be a threat to public safety. Like, let's say the march was full of people with, like, weapons and wearing, like, military uniforms, and let's say it took place in a place called Charlottesville and happened recently. I'm talking about Charlottesville. I'm talking about what happened recently with the people and the guns and the Nazis and the swastikas and the Confederate flags. That seems like an example of a threat to public safety.
I think it's fair to say organized proxy skirmishes in what a loosely affiliated group of white supremacists want to start a race war, right? And we have always known, and we believe in our hearts, that the First Amendment doesn't protect violence. It doesn't. And I think, especially at the affiliate level, where the ACLU's affiliates are repeat players and they're sitting down with the same city attorney talking about the same permit process right in the same corner of, you know, Maine and Charleston, that's visceral and it's real. I did that work for years in Nevada, you know, and I represented Food Not Bombs and the local Catholic Sisters of Mercy. And when I had to defend somebody hateful like the Westboro Baptist Church, and I explained to my clients why I was doing it, it wasn't atmospheric. It wasn't highfalutin First Amendment talk. It was the city attorney is going to shut down a protest on the corner of Sahara and the Strip unless I go and represent Westboro Baptist. My clients got it. It was visceral. It was understandable. I wasn't part of a structural assistance to white supremacy. I was just fighting the man, right? Yeah. I was just a repeat player making sure that the government didn't play guilt by association, didn't crack down on the speech. And I know it helped my homeless clients. I know it helped the Sisters of Catholic Mercy, right? So the problem now is that that work is being done repeatedly in the trenches. And then we as ACLU, right, have to own that, even if on a kind of microcosm, that for them is a more normal way of doing business. And so I think we have a moment here where we have to reflect both on the reality of organized white supremacy and the fact that they are coming to these heavily armed, like, paramilitaries hoping for violence, right? That matters. We shouldn't be defending those people, full stop. That's the worst thing we could do for free speech. And just as a strategic matter, I want people to feel like they can go to a march and bring their five-year-old, right? Yeah. I want that to be part of our civic tradition. I want people to speak truth to power and not feel like the only people who go to a protest are people looking for a violent encounter. So I know in my heart that not just factually on a one-by-one basis, but long-term, we don't want to represent people who are trying to start an armed skirmish. And I think what possibly happened here is there was an inflection point where our right, hitting the nail with the hammer, the doing business, the sitting down at the permit table with the city attorney got eclipsed by our national reality. And I think it was a really important point for us to sit back and take a deep breath and just say we kind of can't keep doing business as usual with groups who are basically going to use us to destroy the First Amendment if they get their way, right? And that's real for me. I think that's real for our affiliate attorneys. And I think now we need to have a real gathering point as ACLU and figure out how do we effectuate our existing policies? How do we put them into play in a way that actually helps freedom of speech, right? And representing armed groups trying to start a race war ain't it. And we all know that.
Yeah.
The thing you said is that in a petri dish, free speech, yes, you know, absolutely all times. But in reality, the line between free speech and hate speech seems pretty amorphous. It's not a clear line.
It is. Hate speech is not a defined term, right? It's amorphous by its very definition, right? What you think is hate speech.
Yes.
I can promise you, Kamau. I mean, I'm sure, I wish I had like Google so I could like make sure I was right. But I'm pretty sure if you Google, you know, Southern law enforcement hate speech, first thing you're going to get is a Black Lives Matter hit, right? Yes. I mean, and that is, that's the bottom line of why I do this work, is that I actually believe, and I've seen it viscerally, that we give the government more power to decide who's hateful and what's hateful. We know how that power is going to be used. And it was used, right, against Black activists in the civil rights era. It's not theoretical. Mm-hmm. And the reason that we could go into court and get an emergency injunction for Martin Luther King Jr., right, which we did, is because we'd helped establish those precedents against legitimately hateful speech. Speech we, too, thought was hateful, right? Yeah. But then when we're trying to defend people who are trying to challenge the status quo, the government's always going to think those people are hateful, too. So that's where I'm still a true believer, right? I think what's harder is when people say, and they've been saying this all week, white supremacy is inherently violent, right? Yeah. Not that it's just hateful, but that a white nationalist mindset, right, if you get your way, presumably leads to some form of ethnic cleansing to get to the ethno state, I assume, right?
Yes,
I haven't really thought through the logistics, fortunately, but I think it's fair to assume there's violence in there. And you know, again, that's where I would say that unless and until you get to that line of inciting violence, and I think reasonable people can disagree about whether or not it happened in Charlottesville, but it was certainly really close. But unless and until you get to that line.
Reason we can disagree about what part?
But whether or not kind of a particular white supremacist rally is incitement as a legal matter, that it reaches the definition that it's unlawful speech, right?
Yeah.
And by the way, I don't think I want an ethno state alone. Right, it is unprotected. Just like let's go punch Nazis alone, right, is protected. And thank God it is, right?
Yeah.
But when you are armed to the teeth, right, and getting in someone's face and you've got your hand on your weapon and you're saying, I don't believe in your right to exist, that altogether, that looks a lot more like incitement on the ground.
And I would say, I think, yes, and you're dressed in military fatigues, which is confusing to people who are there like, oh, here's the military or here's the law enforcement.
Yeah.
And then the police are there. This is what I think. It's people come from Alabama, so I think about things in terms of gumbo a lot.
Yeah.
like these things aren't, you know, the crab and gumbo is not separate from the shrimp and gumbo,
not separate
from the beef and gumbo. So the fact is that free speech, yes, but then if you're a person of color in Charlottesville and, you know, like people of color around the country don't know that the police always have our back.
Of course not.
Yeah. And
of
so you go, okay, so the ACLU fought for this guy's right to say he wants a white ethno state and he's got a gun. And I'm here because I want to say I don't want a white ethno state. But then the cops over here not doing anything while I feel like violence is about to erupt.
Well, let me point out the enemy in this narrative, okay?
Yeah.
It's the Second Amendment. And I'm like fine getting hate mail from the NRA, but it is not
just by saying that it's already already started writing
it's fine, but not on my watch. Okay. At least not on my watch at the ACLU. Are we going to allow the Second Amendment to eclipse the First? Are we going to scapegoat the First? Why are you scared in that scenario? Because the dude's got a gun.
Yeah.
Why are the cops not going to intervene apart from structural white supremacy that has invaded our police forces? Right. The other reason might be they're terrified because they're outgunned, right? Mm-hmm. And we heard that on the ground in Charlottesville, that there were police that seemed shy about intervening. There were, I don't know if you watched the Vice documentary, but there are, you know, at one point, this disgusting, loathsome white supremacist calls the police and basically says, if you guys don't get over here, I'm sending in a paramilitary troop to get them out, right? He's negotiating with the cops as two comparable firepower entities, right?
Yeah.
That is the problem.
Yeah.
The Supreme Court decided that the Second Amendment was an individual right, you know, a dozen years ago. And there's been almost no follow-up guidance from the federal courts about how that interacts with our other cherished freedoms. And I just, it's not right to me that we look at Charlottesville, right? A situation where there was an armed confrontation and where someone decided to murder someone exercising their First Amendment rights with a car and say the problem is the First Amendment. I cannot buy that solution. I don't think the First Amendment is the problem. It's the toxic mix of the First and the Second. And the fact that the Second has not been reined in by the courts means that we're all at risk of having our other liberties completely obliterated in service of this gun god. And I, for one, I don't think we should tolerate that.
You know, if you're a person of color, if you're an oppressed person in this country, if you're openly gay in this country, if you're trans, and if you're all of those things or several of those things combined into one, if you're disabled, the law never looks at you in a neutral way.
I know that. I know that.
Yeah.
And I would never, never be Pollyannish about that. And I would say, you know, I rate nowhere in the oppression Olympics. I'm a white woman that is now a white woman of considerable privilege. But I got into this work because I really believed that there was a place for me in a world that was overwhelmingly white and male and has a lot of characteristics I don't have growing up as a, you know, kind of a poor atheist, right? Mm-hmm. I identified as the oppressed in the ways only a white suburban kid in Connecticut could identify, right? But that's what drove me to this work.
Yes, yeah.
And that's what made the ACLU stand out to me and why I went to law school to work here is because we are complex. There are always going to be times that somebody's unhappy. And I think in some ways it takes a certain firmness to make it through those buffeted winds. And I want people like you, I want people of color, I want affected people, I want people who feel marginalized to challenge us.
Well, thank you for coming by today. I really appreciate it. And I just want to thank the ACLU. Thank you.
Thanks.
Wow, that was a great interview with Lee Rowland.
Yeah, it was really easy to sort of go back and forth, and we could have a great back and forth conversation without being interrupted.
You should maybe do this professionally.
Yeah,
have you thought about that, interviewing people professionally, maybe for a TV show?
Mm, that's a good idea. Let me write that down.
Yeah, I think you'd probably get a couple of Cable Ace Awards for it.
We'll be right back after we take care of some business and some business.
All right, back to the show.
Well, this next one, we're back together, me and you.
Yeah, this is great. This is with Mark Bray, who joins us now to talk about the Antifa movement in the U.S. and how it's combating the rising alt-right. Mark is a political organizer and historian of human rights, terrorism, and political radicalism in modern Europe. He is currently a lecturer at Dartmouth College and has a new book out this week called Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. Mark details the early days of the movement as it formed almost simultaneously with fascism itself to fight Hitler and Mussolini, up to the present day.
Good summer read.
It's a good... It's some light summer reading.
when the revolution is happening during the summer.
You know, I'm out on the beach. I'm getting some rays reading Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. Honestly, that sounds about right for me.
Yeah, I would
do that. Let's get Mark in here.
This interview was recorded on August 22nd, 2017. The rapper Beanie Man turned 44 on this day. He still has not found the keys to his Beamer, Simsema.
So my first question, I try to make sure in my life that but at the bare minimum, I have the correct pronunciation. How do you pronounce it? Is it Antifa? Is it Antifa?
Antifa. The emphasis is on the first syllable.
Oh, Antifa.
Yeah.
Antifa.
Yeah. But, you know, I don't get too hung up on pronunciation, but that's how they say it.
Oh, but that's a third way I've never heard.
Yeah, I've never heard. So wait, so it's like as if it's like your aunt, like anti-fascist.
Yeah. Antifa. It's...
So what is Antifa and what's its history in the U.S.?
Antifa is essentially a shortened term for anti-fascism. It obviously originated in Europe in the 20s and 30s and 40s. In the U.S., it was essentially a derivation of movements that developed in Europe in the 70s and 80s among immigrants and leftists to defend themselves against the emergence of a neo-Nazi skinhead scene. And that skinhead scene also found its emergence in the U.S. in the 80s and 90s. And so what was called anti-racist action were the Antifa of the U.S. during that era. And they essentially organized to stop the advance of white supremacy, neo-Nazism, and so forth.
Is it one group? Because I was a little confused about whether Antifa was one group or a series of groups that are together, whether there's a single philosophy or whether it kind of varies depending on the issue. Like, how does it work exactly?
Right. So it's sort of like an activity or a mode of politics. So there is no one group. There's no central command. Anyone can form their own anti-fascist group. In the U.S., there is a Torch network, which is sort of a network of about a dozen groups that are loosely affiliated through that. But most of the groups are independent and autonomous and organize their own methods of combating the far right.
So I feel like when I watch the news, you know, it's sort of very simplified. It's like on the one side, there's the alt-right. On the other side, there's Antifa. And as if these are two opposing forces that are, you know, sort of equal. What is your frustration when you hear the mainstream news media talk about Antifa?
Well, there's this like real obsession in the mainstream media about being able to put everything into little boxes. So, I mean, if you look at Charlottesville, for example, there were counter-protesters against the Unite the Right White Power rally from all sorts of different political parties and unions and groups, but they all sort of get lumped into this one category. And the Trump comments about violence on both sides, good people on both sides, is intended to kind of play into the notion of extremism, which says everything that's not in the center is essentially the same, whether you're ISIS or anarchists. And so like that is very frustrating because we should make a better effort to actually understand where people were coming from, whether we agree with them or not.
Yeah, it's been really weird how like anti-fascist and fascist are kind of equated with each other, because it's like, you know, well, it's like Antifa is anti-fascist. Like, we're supposed to believe in anti-fascism. It's like, well, that side has bad. Well, the other side has good. Yes, those are different things. That oppose, yeah. You know, like we have to have some set of values we're fighting for and what we're fighting against. So it's confusing. Right. I mean, how much of it is, you know, like if people were calling it anti-fascist, how much of it is just as simple as like calling it something else? Like calling it the allied forces. Right. Like, does it take that?
the independent allied forces.
Right.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're onto something, because I mean, even I spoke to my mother about this, and my mother's like, you know, when I hear anti-fascist, I think of fascist.
Oh, that's,
you know,
funny.
So there is some sort of a barrier with that, and there actually are some groups that sort of come out of this tradition that are now coming up with other names. Like, one of the more active Antifa chapters or groups in the country is Smash Racism DC, and they call themselves Smash Racism DC, right? That way you sort of bypass the conversation.
I feel like when I hear that, like, you know, that the alt-right is showing up, like, to my neighborhood, like they plan on doing soon, and then I hear that Antifa is showing up, just, you know, and in my mind, like, well, yeah, if somebody's coming to bring violence, and you don't know if you can trust the police forces to help you out with that, it's good. I feel like it's good to know that somebody else there is can sort of also build a wall for you. It can also form a force. And then there's all these people on the left that I know who are like, no, all violence is wrong. And I'm not advocating for violence. Yeah. I'm just advocating for right. less people getting beaten up. And how do you think about violence in Antifa?
Yeah, that's a real good thing to advocate for, is less people getting beaten up. I mean, we can even see the clergy that showed up to Charlottesville to engage in acts of civil disobedience to block the white supremacists from getting into the park. They're like, let's show up to get arrested to make a point. And then there was no one there to arrest them. There were no police around. And then they've said very clearly that if it weren't for the anti-fascists who stood in front of them as hundreds of neo-Nazis with clubs and shields were charging at them, they said they literally saved their lives. So with Charlottesville, they reached out to like the parents of some of these white supremacists who disown their kids for being Nazis. They reach out to their employers, got them fired. And so there's a lot that can be done that these groups do that don't even involve the question of confrontation. It's important to understand.
You know, when people think of Antifa, I think that sometimes there's the idea of like, they show up with their brass knuckles and the other side has their weapons and it's a good old street fight. I mean, like, what are the various things that you'll see Antifa doing and have done throughout the years?
Right. Well, one of the main things is using the fact that, hey, most people hate Nazis, right? This should not be a hard sell, right? This should be a real easy sell to most people. And so using that opposition in the public sphere through what's come to be known as doxing, right? Doxing is finding out someone's personal information and making it public. And so if someone is in private going on these hateful message boards, making jokes about gas chambers and saying that Hitler was right, simply letting their neighbors know, letting their bosses know, is a humongously powerful tool to like shut this down and to really shame people for trying to organize for a white ethno state. So a lot of it has to do with doxing. A lot of it has to do with finding out where white power events are being held. And a lot of times they're organized under like really innocuous names like Conference for European Civilization or something. Mm-hmm. And contacting the venue owner and letting them know, hey, you're hosting a Nazi event. We don't think you should do that. And a lot of times, you know, hotels or VFWs don't want any part of that, and they're happy to simply shut it down. So a lot of it is information, phone calls, getting in touch. And also a lot of times you can shut down an event or drown out speakers without any sort of confrontation through I spoke to some folks down in Texas who organized this really rowdy puppet show in front of like some Klansmen on the steps of a courthouse that really mimicked them and obscured what they were doing. So there's a range of things that have been done and really have been done even back since the 40s. This is an old kind of repertoire.
When is violence used then? And when is because you say direct action, when is violence and force used?
Right. Well, ultimately, the perspective of anti-fascists is that the entire activity is a mode of self-defense that would not be necessary if it weren't for the fact that fascism is inherently violence, right? Violence is at the core of what fascism and Nazism and white power are. And so they're basically, there's different contexts, right? So there's a context where a lot of the early Antifa groups formed literally as a sort of desperate need to defend themselves against attacks on social centers, on punk venues, on migrant neighborhoods. And so in that sense, like, for example, in Greece, which has a really unfortunately brutal struggle between fascists and anti-fascists at the moment, there are, for example, anti-fascist motorcycle patrols that patrol in immigrant neighborhoods because immigrants are getting murdered fairly regularly. Another context, though, that's probably more germane to the United States is when you show up to protest a big far-right gathering, whether or not, who sort of starts whatever, there's always a concern that if the police are not standing there, you're going to get attacked. And that is what happened in Charlottesville. And so being ready to defend oneself is, I think, not that unwise. There's more to be said, obviously, but that gives you some sense of the range, I think.
How does Antifa view free speech?
I interviewed a bunch of anti-fascists for this book, and there's sort of two main camps that they fall on in my experience on this question. The first camp is to say, we're not against free speech. We're not the government. We're not censoring anyone. We're not calling on the government to do anything. We're against fascist and white supremacist organizing. That is a threat. we want to organize against it. There's another camp who essentially says, no free speech for fascists. You're a fascist. Sorry, that's not something that we're going to, as a society, take seriously or let you promote. So, you know, there's two different views on it. But the more fundamental kind of thing for listeners to understand is, rather than seeing fascism as kind of like this quirky opinion that should be included with all other opinions in this, you know, open discourse, the kind of market of free market of ideas, anti-fascists see fascism and Nazism and white supremacy as a political enemy to be organized against and hopefully eradicated as an idea. And that is a different way of looking at it. It's not a matter of kind of let's kind of come up with an arrangement where fascists and their victims can kind of coexist easily, but really try to create a world where this isn't even a conversation anymore. And like you'd think after World War II, we'd be like, all right, let's pull the plug on that and move on. But it's sad that we're still talking about it.
Yeah, wasn't there a period of time before World War II where they were trying to figure out how to appease Hitler and kind of find a way where, like, the, you know, him and his victims could kind of coexist, and and then there was like a war.
Yeah,
there was, and you know, during that period leading up to that, even on the left, a lot of people thought that this wasn't going to be that serious, and so part of the anti-fascist argument is you treat it seriously from the beginning, so you don't have to say, "Ooh, we should have treated it more seriously early on," when it's too late.
So basically, sometimes if there's a sense of like, if we just beat up these Nazis who show up to the park, then we won't have to go to war.
Well, one of the guys I spoke to from Baltimore said, you know, we write letters and make phone calls so we don't have to fight them with our fists. We fight them with our fists so we don't have to fight them with knives, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so like the idea is to try to do this without violence. And if there is a conflict, try to end it with the minimal level of confrontation. This is a politics that tries to prevent another civil war.
Thank you, Mark.
That was great, Mark. Thank you.
Thank you. Been a pleasure.
Wow, that was great, Kamau. I think everybody should go out and get Antifa, the anti-fascist handbook. All right, up next, Kamau speaks to April Rain. She's a self-described agitator who started the hashtag OscarSoWhite and most recently, No Confederate. April created Oscar So White in 2015 to spark a conversation about the Academy's all-white nominees that year and inspired greater representation of people of color in film. Now, April's at it again with a new hashtag she co-created with a group of women. Hashtag No Confederate objects to the proposed HBO alternative historical series, which reimagines the Civil War as if the South won and slavery remained legal. It's like a world where Black people are paid little to nothing and where racists are like publicly marching on the street and have power?
Huh.
You mean the news? HBO is doing the news?
It's a dramatic reenactment of CNN panel segments. It's already Jeffrey Lord's favorite television
I was about
show.
To say, Jeffrey Lord's back, baby. He was waiting for a show like this.
They're gonna
no
show,
Confederate.
They're going to show up for the first day of the read-through, and he's just going to be there. I hear you need me. All right, Harry, I got to leave you behind on this one, because time for a black people meeting.
Bye.
This was recorded on Monday, August 21st. That means already missed solar eclipse.
For a lot of people, you came to prominence with Oscars So White, hashtag Oscars So White. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of times people, when they're doing hashtags, there's like a coordinated plan and a study group and a focus group. And we're all going to get on here at this one appointed time and we're going to try to get this to trend. Was that something that when you're like, here we go? Or, you know, did it just sort of like, was it more spontaneous than that?
It was unbelievably organic when I created Oscar So White. I was, I would love to have a sexy story. You know, I was sitting around the boardroom with my people and we decided that for the next 18 months, this was going to be our focus and we called it. No, I was half dressed in my family room, half dressed because I was getting ready for work and I was going to watch the Oscar nominations announced on TV as I did every year because I'm a huge movie fan.
For performance by an actor in a leading role, the nominees are Bryan Cranston in Trumbo, Matt Damon in The Martian, Leonardo DiCaprio in The Revenant, Michael Fassbender in Steve Jobs, and Eddie Redmayne in The Danish Girl.
And it just struck me. And obviously, 2015, when I created the hashtag, was not the first time that we have seen a dearth of marginalized communities. So I'm not sure why it hit me that year. But category after category, both in front of and behind the camera, there was just, it was so homogenous. You know, there weren't, and I'm not just talking Black, and we can talk about that, but, you know, Oscar So White is not binary. It's all races, all ethnicities, all genders, all sexual orientations, but it was just incredibly homogenous. And I took to Twitter with the first tweet that said, "Oscar So White, they asked to touch my hair." And then I put the phone down and I finished getting dressed and I went on to work. I checked during lunchtime and it was trending internationally. And then I realized that this may in fact be a thing.
So it was just that one tweet, "Oscar So White, they asked to touch my hair." And then you're like, "Let me go about my day. Boop-a-doo." And meanwhile, your life was changing forever.
Yes.
I respect the work you do, but I have to say, it really angers me because I'm a person who like thinks, here's the hashtag that's going to set a generation ablaze. I should probably call the T-shirt companies already just to get this ready to go. And then I see them limp out to nothingness. So, like...
Yeah, you never ever know.
So when you first heard about Confederate, how quickly did it strike you that I'm needed here? Like, you know, it was like that the bat signal had gone up or the black signal had gone up. Like this is a problem.
Yeah, immediately, but it was in an individual capacity. So I am not the one who said, you know, we need to get together and figure out what to do as a group. That was actually Chanel Little, who's one of the No Confederate campaign people with me and three other women. So I spoke out immediately, you know, and now that I'm the Oscar So White lady, people look to me for... on all issues, entertainment, which is fine, which is great. So Roxane Gay's piece came out in the New York Times. People were obviously very upset, but I was just talking in my individual capacity about how incredibly bad I thought the idea was. And then Chanel reached out to the four of us. And then we said, you know, let's do something. You know, and so in that group, it's me, Chanel Little, Lauren Warren, Jamie Broadnax, who is the founder of Black Girl Nerds, who has an incredible platform, and Rebecca Theodore, who is an amazing film critic. And so she has lots of connections to, you know, various entertainment publications and that kind of thing. So the five of us sort of assembled like Voltron, I like to say, and said, you know, let's get Confederate out the paint.
I think it's great that you said this, that you love the entertainment industry. You know what I mean? You love the Oscars. You're the person who's getting up in the morning to watch that when they announce the Oscars. Because I think that there's probably a narrative around you that I see about you sort of being sort of like a hater. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I hate injustice.
Yes.
But, you know, I am the Oscars were my Super Bowl. I also like football. But, you know, I mean, I would make snacks. I would, you know, pregame, meaning, you know, I watched all the red carpet, whatever. So, yes, I am a lover of the entertainment industry. And so I've been working to make it better.
And do you watch Game of Thrones?
I do not watch Game of Thrones. I am the only American.
Nope, me and you both. We're together. We're sitting together on this one.
I watch Power on Stars instead at 9 p.m. on Sunday evening.
What are your thoughts about the idea that, like, you're hurting somebody's artistic voice and you're not letting art be art? And art is, I believe, the children are the future and other things.
Now, HBO agrees that they did it horribly. Like, this rollout, it didn't even make sense to me why they would roll this out now, but they did. Mm-hmm. And it was done badly, and they admit that it was done badly. But if that's what you're going to give us, and then in the subsequent interviews, if you're not going to clean it up and you're actually going to make it worse, then absolutely, I will judge HBO, you billion-dollar corporation. I'm going to judge what you have put out there, because you're a professional and you put out what you wanted to be out. period. Now, with respect to art for art's sake, I absolutely believe in art for art's sake. And so that isn't saying that Benioff and Weiss, who are the two producers of Game of Thrones, who would also be the executive producers and the showrunners for Confederate, I'm not saying that they should never write another story or what have you. I'm saying it's this particular story. What is it about Benioff and Weiss, or what is it about the press release that speaks to you about slavery fan fiction and the commodification of black pain that we have never seen before, that this is going to be the one show that completely turns your mind around so that you now understand that slavery was bad, right? Because we've had a bazillion movies and books and TV shows that have already said that have made that case.
So you created hashtag No Confederate before the country found itself in the midst of a national dialogue about the Confederacy and statues and monuments. What are your thoughts now? I mean, you know, we've been talking about how in this current context.
What we see in Charlottesville, what we see around the country, is life imitating art and art imitating life. You know, I think what we said even before Charlottesville, but which has been buoyed and energized only now, is we don't need an alternate history, as it's being called by HBO. We're living it every day, you know? So how can you call a show Confederate and say black people are enslaved and are inferior when we have Dylan Roof, you know, walking into a house of peace and killing 9 black parishioners of a church in South Carolina, when you have the state of Texas literally rewriting its textbooks so that Africans and African Americans who were brought to the country in chains were not slaves. They don't even say enslaved. They were slaves. But they were merely servants. As if, you know, well, they're going to do the slavery thing until they find something better on LinkedIn, and then they're going to be out, right?
Yeah, yeah.
When we have the vestiges of slavery and the Confederacy and Jim Crow still playing out in mass incarceration, in inequality with respect to housing and education, and then we see violence, you know, we see that young woman killed, Heather Heyer, in Charlottesville because she was speaking out against injustice. Why do we need a show that supposedly is going to teach people how bad the Confederacy was or what have you when we see it being played out? The other issue is the show to me, just on a logical plane, doesn't make sense. Okay, what we know about Confederate is that it takes place after the Third Civil War, but it's also supposed to be modern day. Now, you can check my math, but we've only had one Civil War so far. So apparently we're going to have two very quickly, which, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So let's say it's 50 years or 100 years in the future. Okay, let's go. I'll give them that.
Yeah.
But then after this Third Civil War, black people are enslaved. Again. like let's just walk this through.
Yeah.
What you're telling me is that after, you know, 100 years from now, you believe that black people are so inferior, Benioff and Weiss, that we're going to let either ourselves or our descendants be caught up and enslaved again. Does that make sense? Right?
Yeah.
Does it make sense?
Man, we just can't seem to escape being enslaved.
Right.
It happened again.
Right. Oh, well, I guess we got to go on down to the South. You know, what does that mean? And based on what we see happening, the incredible anti-racism, anti-Confederate response that we're seeing in real time in Boston, in Durham, in Charlottesville, all over the country now, don't you think that Americans, much less the rest of the world, would rise up and say, hey, South, you can't enslave folks anymore. We've done that. We're not going to let that slide, right? So have they even thought about whether the premise itself makes sense? I think that there are better ways to do it. You know, and for example, Will Packer, who is the producer of the amazing hit film Girls Trip, which is still out right now, you know, is going to do a show show called Black America. And that's going to be on Amazon. And that was announced not too long after the Confederate stuff blew up, which was incredibly smart on Amazon and Will's part. But this one is going to be about Black people receiving reparations after Reconstruction and separating and taking the states of Mississippi, Louisiana, and Alabama and thriving, right? Now that is alternate history because we've never seen that.
Yes. So what if I'm somebody who works at HBO and I call you up and go, April, this has been too much heat on us. This has been too crazy. How about we do this? Every time we air Confederate, we immediately air a 2-hour episode of Insecure.
Nope. No.
That's not it.
No, I mean, first of all, there aren't 2-hour episodes, but but what they're saying is we know this is bad and it shows Black people in a bad light, but we're going to do it anyway, but we're going to try to mollify you with another show about Black people. Like, that is incredibly insulting to me. Like, I'm half mad at you, Kamau, for even to do that.
Sorry. I just took a chance. Sorry about that. Please don't hashtag me out of existence.
Yeah, my next campaign is Kamau out the paint.
Oh, no. I'm getting sweaty just thinking about that.
But I think that HBO has options, you know, and we have suggested to them. Again, you know, there are other alt fiction, alt history ideas that you can do. You can pick up Underground, right, which is still looking for a home. So if you really have to do something on slavery, why not do something that you already know has a dedicated fan base, has a fantastic showrunner in Black woman Misha Green, you know, has great writing, great cast, and we would 100% support that. So that's option number one. Option number two is, hey, Benioff and Weiss, you obviously know that you have the leverage to be able to push through any idea that you want at HBO right now, whether it is good or bad. So in the spirit of diversity and inclusion, why don't you take a back seat and uplift the Spellmans, your Black writing friends, and let them pitch an idea to HBO, and maybe that would be something that we could deal with a little bit better than this slavery fan fiction thing, you know? Or, you know, and this is, to date, it has not been about HBO, it has not been about Game of Thrones, so we haven't said, you know, boycott either one of those, because, you know, Game of Thrones is a fan favorite, and if you've been rocking with the, you know, the depictions of women and race for 6 years, it doesn't make sense for us to try and stop you from doing that now in its penultimate season, right? I think there's one episode left in this season, one more season, and then that's done. But what we are saying to HBO is, if you don't get this right now and quickly, what we were able to do in 3 days' time, when we announced the No Confederate campaign on Friday, it was early morning Friday, and then what we said is we are going to have the hashtag trend nationally and hopefully internationally, and it did, on Sunday. So we had 3 days, right, to sort of galvanize the power of social media and show HBO that, you know, we really weren't playing. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it did trend. And according to the Twitter analytics, in that three-day time period, we had over 125,000 no Confederate tweets from literally around the world. Wow. We had people from Pakistan and Singapore and Japan, you know, hitting me up. Hey, you know, you've got support from Brazil, you know, that kind of thing. We also had people say, I didn't even have a Twitter account, but I heard about this and I created a Twitter account specifically to say no Confederate. That's big, right?
Wow. The
Confederate show wouldn't even go into production until after Game of Thrones is over. So that means 2018, 2019, before we even see an episode. What we're saying to HBO is make the correct business decision now, not to expend millions of dollars per episode, because that's literally what it would be, and the time and the resources and whatever, because we, the five Black women who are running the No Confederate campaign, aren't going away. And if we can galvanize support around the world in 3 days, imagine what we can do within a year and a half of organization.
Wow. That, yeah, if I'm HBO, I'm like, yeah, let's have another meeting about this. Maybe we need to talk this through one more time.
The interesting thing is HBO has doubled down. After what happened in Charlottesville, HBO released another press release saying, well, you know, give us a chance. Let's wait and see. Don't judge until, you know, it's out there. And my response to that is that's what they said about Donald Trump. And look at where we are.
Okay. Good point. April, thank you for talking to us today.
My pleasure.
Kamal, what did you learn today?
I learned from Lee Rowland of the ACLU that she totally understands if you have issues with what the ACLU did in Virginia, and that there's a lot of people at the ACLU who are also struggling with that.
And I learned that we're dealing with a toxic mix of First and Second Amendment rights where the Second Amendment hasn't been reined in by the courts.
And I've learned, and this makes me sad to have learned this, that because the law is the law, you have to represent the worst people sometimes in order to protect the best people.
Is there anything else you learned from any of the other guests?
I learned that it's pronounced Antifa, not Antifa, or Antifa. Oh, this is like the whole Appalachia thing I did with the United States. I'm never going to say these things right.
I learned Antifa is about self-defense. Violence is at the core of fascism and white power. And early Antifa groups formed as self-defense to white supremacists.
I've learned that when you put the word fascism in your name, sometimes people get focused on that word and just think you are fascists. and that some Antifa organizations have changed their names, like Smash Racism DC. I like that whole idea.
I like that very much, though.
I like the city of DC. I like smashing racism. I'm all in.
Yeah, it's hard to argue, Antifa. Well, like, look, the left has their racism is bad group.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, what about them? What about the racism is bad group?
Yeah. It's a much easier thing. But not that I'm encouraging Antifa to change their name. I have a name that's difficult for people too, and I'm keeping it too.
I also learned that a big anti-fascist argument is that you have to treat fascism seriously from the beginning before it's too late. And one example of this is World War II.
Huh. Wait, should we be reading our history books?
Well, not our history books, but anything Howard Zinn wrote, yeah. I also learned from your wonderful interview with April Rain that the hashtag OscarSoWhite movement was developed organically in April's living room, and she went about her day not realizing it would change her life forever.
I learned that unlike OscarSoWhite, hashtag NoConfederate was completely intentional and formed with four other black women. You can find them on Twitter, at Chanel Little, at FilmFatale_NYC, at I am Lauren P, and at Jamie Broadnax. That's JAMIEBROADNAX.
And I learned that April Rain said that the Oscars are her Super Bowl, but she won't tolerate injustice. So basically, her Oscars are like my spelling bee.
Yes, that's right. I need a Super Bowl. And the other thing I learned in this episode is I prefer when you're there for the interview, sorry.
So,
yeah, come on.
Thanks, man.
Maybe work a little harder.
Yeah, I'll try to work a little harder. I'm just lazy, man. ever since I got that first Emmy nomination, I just haven't. Wait a second, that wasn't me.
No, that wasn't me.
I have no excuse.
Yeah. That's going to do it for our show. Thanks again to Lee Rowland of the ACLU, April Rain, and Mark Bray. On Twitter, you can follow the ACLU at ACLU. They must have got to Twitter early. You can follow April at Rain of April. That's REIGNOFAPRIL. And you can follow Mark Bray at Mark_Bray. That's MARK_BRAY. Keep those Twitter and Facebook messages coming. We absolutely love them. Thank you to Eagle Moon, who tweeted, after listening to Killer Mike, I am fully inspired to engage in my local community politics. And Nerd Logic, at NerdLogic0_O, who said, we need to come up with a fan app where progressives can meet other progressives to discuss the podcast and share strategies. And maybe even get a date with Hari. I added that last part. Thank you. You all keep us going. So keep those comments and questions coming using the hashtag PoliticallyReactive. Find us on Twitter at PoliticReactive, and you can find us on Facebook as PoliticallyReactive. We still have a limited supply of new t-shirts, so don't miss out. Visit podswag.com/PR or podswag.com/PoliticallyReactive. Both work, And yes, we are still working on getting shirts in different cuts, bigger sizes, and baby sizes. Also, why don't you pick up a copy of my new book, The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell. One reviewer on Amazon, Leona, said she appreciates just how awkward I am. She also said the book, quote, has the wit to offer each of us a lifeline to recognizing where we are, hashtag asleep, and ways we can be better people with each other. Aw, thanks, Leona. Pick up a copy at your favorite local bookstore or at wkamaubell.com. Also, while you're there, you can get a copy of my new album, Semi-Prominent Negro. It's on Kill Rock Stars. And if you're in Pittsburgh on Thursday, August 24th, or Friday, August 25th, you can see me as part of the Pittsburgh Comedy Festival. Google Pittsburgh Comedy Festival, get tickets. And get a copy of Hari's new comedy album, Hari Kondabolu's New Material Night, Volume 1. You can find it at harikondabolu.com. And you can see Hari live in Philadelphia on August 24th, 25th, and 26th. Oh, he'll be in Philly while I'm in Pittsburgh. Those aren't really close to each other. And he'll be in Baltimore, Maryland on August 27th. And he'll be in Portland, Maine on August 30th. And he'll be in Vermont at the Vermont Comedy Club from August 31st through September 2nd. He's also coming to Oakland. He's also doing Boston. He's all over the place. Visit harikondabolu.com for details. Politically Reactive is a production of Topic and distributed by Earwolf. Our executive producers are Lisa Linegang and Lital Malad. The show is produced by Tim Barnes and Laura Flynn. The show is engineered by Dan Gallucci. Thanks to Jared O'Connell at Earwood Studios in New York for help recording the show this week. And thanks as always to Brontez Purnell for providing music for the show. Thanks for listening to Politically Reactive.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii.